Hey. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As a South African, I would start with an apology. I would like to apologize for the chairperson. The chairperson is on his way. In 10 minutes' time, he will be around. But meanwhile, whilst we're waiting for the chairperson, it should be proper that we begin with our meeting so that we're not left behind with time. Today you are going to have two reports from the NSFAS and also from the CHE. And I know the portfolio committee members are ready for the reports and also to interrogate the reports that will be coming forth. But before we do that, can we take this opportunity to introduce ourselves? I'll start on the side of the portfolio committee where we'll introduce ourselves. I'll start by myself. I'm Nomalunge Lukina. I am the member of the portfolio committee and the whip in the committee. So can I, Anele, can you introduce yourself so then we continue. Thanks.
Anele Kabinge, committee secretary.
I'm Faith Kwaza from Parliamentary Communication Services.
Wendy Nelson, a member of the committee.
Silence Makuvela, member of the committee as well.
I'm Janita Topis-Lazens, member of the committee.
And a colleague, Antrika Shonabesh Station.
Good afternoon. My name is Jake Dikobo. I'm a member of the committee.
My name is Crosby Moni, a member of the committee. Chobe.
Thank you very much, members of the committee. DG, as the committee has introduced, as they have introduced themselves, by those that were welcoming you, we know that you are leading the delegation, the two delegations that we are having. And for now, can I give the opportunity to you, DG, to lead the introduction of the delegation?
Thank you, Madam. My name is Gwes Konde. That is for higher education and training.
President Sophie, I'm responsible for monitoring evaluation for the higher education and training.
I'm Lamayedwa Sokaise. I'm the chairperson of the board of the National Student Financial Aid Scheme.
Stephen Smith, member of the board and chairman of the audit committee.
Paul Slack, Acting Chief Financial Officer, National Student Financial Aid Scheme.
Nathan Johnstone, Member of the Board, Chairman of the Finance Committee and a Member of the Audit and Risk Committee.
Ahmed Yusuf, CEO of the CAG.
Dean Stradu, CFO, Department of Higher Education and Training.
Diane Parker, Acting Deputy Director, General University Education, DHET.
Shaima Khova, Chief Director, University Financial Planning and Information Systems.
Thank you for the introduction. We know how important this meeting is. The role that is played by the two committees that have just introduced themselves, these bodies that we have. But before we even offer an opportunity, because I think we are going to be starting with the NSFAS, the presentation from the NSFAS. I wonder if the DG has any ways that you want to put forward before we hand over to the NSFAS chairperson.
Yeah, thank you very much. What I would like to indicate, having been given this opportunity, to draw to the attention of the portfolio committee, because we were here before, and the situation at NSFAS was quite precarious, fraught with many challenges. And that came about as a result of a number of systemic as well as policy matters that couldn't find their way in terms of the institution discharging its own responsibilities. The assessment we made then, which required some interventions that took place in December 2010 and got finalized by early January in 2011, were informed by quite a number of challenges that were confronting the institution. And members of the committee would recall that one of the issues that were identified were in the form of some long-standing and deep-rooted problems which have been exacerbated by poor decisions by the previous board as well as the management there, which then required an intervention in the entity. And that intervention was effected as from the 7th of January 2011, after which the mandate that was given to the incoming board led by EXCO was that a turnaround has to be in 3 months' time. And from then, we demanded a report on a monthly basis. NSFAS is going to speak for itself. When I found out from the auditor, a general, they told me that they are pleased about the progress they see there. And they've thus unqualified NSFAS because they are satisfied by the work and the system that have been put in place. So I think in its presentation, NSFAS will outline these issues and the progress that has been made, because there is still a lot of work that has to be done. But it has begun on a correct footing, and we can see results already at the present moment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, DG. Can I then hand over to NSFAS to give us a presentation?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, the DG of the Department of Higher Education and Training, members of the board of NSFAS, and members from the Department of Higher Education. Good afternoon. Chairperson, as the DG has indicated, we are here to present the annual report 2011. And our presentation will outline the following. I'm going to summarize the report as the chairperson. I'm going to talk about the board issues. I'm going to talk about the board committee issues, annual financial statements, annual performance report. And thereafter, our report is going to chart a way forward. I'm going to share this report with other members of the board. I'm going to take you through right now. 2010 was a challenging year for NSFAS. I think the DG has alluded to that effect. as the new members of the board that came in, we were confronted by the issue of the Auditor General issued a disclaimer of opinion for 2009-2010. But I must say that it was not the only issue. Board members resigned in 2010. Meaning, therefore, we had new members that were appointed, and those members were given a mandate to focus on the following: develop and implement a turnaround strategy, which we think it worked wonders. Maintain NSFAS functions while implementing turnaround. We used to come and say to you here that we are going to fix this place while flying. We did exactly that, and we are still doing it. There is no time. We must make it work. Again, in terms of our mandate, we needed to address what I indicated earlier on, the 2010 disclaimer of opinion by Auditor General. And let me say this upfront. I'm very pleased to be able to report to you that we have achieved a major milestone in the turnaround strategy by having an unqualified audit in 2011. That has not come as a miracle. We worked hard in the turnaround strategy. But, Sir Person, let me take you back in terms of the NSFAS Act 56 of 1999. Because I think giving the report without necessary focusing the mandate as given by the Act will be misleading this House. NSFAS, as we all know, is a public entity which has 7 functions. I think that is very important, and I want to underline public entity, because when we got there as the board in a turnaround strategy, we find so many things that were defocusing this very important organization in our country. Just to run quickly in terms of these 7 functions, we are to develop criteria and conditions for the granting of loans and bursaries to eligible students in consultation with the minister, and in this case it is the Minister of Higher Education and Training. We are to raise funds. We are to allocate funds for loans and bursaries to eligible students. We are to recover loans, maintain and analyze database, and undertake research of the better utilization of financial resources. I'm just outlining this. These are the functions that are listed for us in the NSFAS Act. But I just want to say to the members today that in terms of these functions, you'll find that everything revolves around the student. And this board has taken a conscious decision that going forward, the money must follow the student. So as we start way forward in terms of this annual report, we are going to be able to tell you that moving forward, we are going to focus to a student. But let me talk about the board composition and its committees. Again, guided by the Act, the board has 13 appointed members, 4 co-opted, and the board has got 2 major committees, in the form of the executive and finance. But besides that, we also know that, as we did even in the turnaround strategy, focus on audit and risk committee. We'll talk about that later. I must say to you that in October 2010, the minister assessed board performance and identified challenges. And that assessment was followed by the resignation of 5 board members and 6 remain. And later on, the 3 members were co-opted. That includes myself as the chairperson of the board of NSFAS. The Department of Higher Education and Training completed the process of filling the 8 vacancies this year. And I'm happy to report to you that, as I'm speaking to you, chairperson, we are operating as a full complement of the board. All 13 members of the board are there. One of the issues that we dealt with during the period under review was the management and leadership of the organization. I must say that when we're dealing with this turnaround strategy, everything was revolving around leadership. And I think that was key in NSFAS that we needed to fix. And therefore the board took a decision to fix all the issues around the leadership at NSFAS. It was a pity that the process picked up a situation whereby, as we report in this period, the CEO probation had to be extended, because we were busy with this turnaround strategy. But whilst we were busy with that process, providing leadership, the CEO had to be suspended in February 2011. In April 2011, the employment of the former CEO could not be confirmed after probation. And then the contract was terminated. I'm going to move faster in that point. That is a matter that we reported several times when we interact with the committee here in the parliament. I must say to you that NSFAS has a number of challenges. Amongst those challenges, we have got the issue of vacancies, especially at the executive level, because any organization needs leadership, needs people. But in the turnaround strategy, as this board, we are in the process of filling all the vacancies. And I can tell you right now, from the 1st of December, NSFAS will have the new CEO, NSFAS will have the new CFO, and NSFAS is committed to make sure that all other important top executive vacancies will be filled with immediate effect, and that process is running very fast. Going back to the committees of NSFAS, the board on day-to-day issues is led, especially the turnaround strategy, by the executive committee. I'm the board chairperson. I'm also chairing the executive committee. But also to maintain the connection, as we are guided by the Act, within the executive committee, we've got a representative of the Department of Higher Education and Training, Mr. Shai Makoba, I think, is also part of us here. And in the board, we have a total of 5. We've got 3 other members who are also with me today. And on my left is Colette Kane. On my right is Stephen Smith. And far on the other side is Nathan Johnston. All these are members that are serving in the board, in the executive committee of NESPAS. The Act core functions determined by the board are determined by the board in terms of the Section 10 of the NESPAS Act. I think if we go through the Act, you'll know what is the role of the executive. And amongst other things, we are to develop and implement. In fact, we decided that this executive must make sure that we must develop and implement the turnaround strategy, which required us to conduct a due diligence of the entity, its risks, commitments, and resourcing needs. Ladies and gentlemen, at this point in time, as I indicated that I'm going to share this annual report with my colleagues, I'm going to hand over to the chairperson of the Audit and Risk Committee to report on the details under this committee. And that is Stephen Smith. Take us through.
Can I interrupt, please? Mr. Soga, you say, as you are still handing over to another person, I'm also handing over my duties to the chairperson of the committee. Chairperson, I apologize for you for late coming.
Thank you, Christina. Okay. So, Stephen, you are in capable hands of Advocate Malan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chairman. As the Chairman has introduced, I'm Stephen Smith. I am the Chairman of the Audit Committee for NISFAS. I was also a member of the Ministerial Review Committee that spent some 6, 8, 9 months reviewing in depth the state of health and also the strategy for NISFAS going forward. One of the things that happened with the change of guard at the end of 2010 going into 2011 was that I was asked to be part of the executive committee and also to apply myself at an extraordinary level compared to what would normally be required in terms of how NISFAS gained traction in what was required to get it onto the strategic path that the review committee had recommended. Its report, I think, of March 2010. And then secondly, and importantly, the interventions that were necessary to secure a improved audit. A colleague of mine, Nathan Johnson, is a member of the audit committee and was also appointed to the executive committee. Sitting on my right is Paul Flack, who project managed the year end from an accounting perspective. He resigned from the audit committee to be able to do that. So when the Auditor General did the review at year end of NISFAS's finances, but also of the leadership interventions and the leadership issues, this particular comment that we've cited in the slide was made, that although this might have increased the risk of loss of independence of the audit committee, what I've just described to you, the interventions were in the end sound. Just move on to the slides. Just you've heard this before, but just to recap in terms of the issues that were raised in the 2010 report, one of the big challenges which NISFAS faced was how to value the loan book, which goes back a good number of years to 1991, at fair value at initial recognition. This is an accounting standard that requires that assets on a balance sheet are not valued at subjective valuations, but effectively would reflect a value that would be agreeable between parties at arm's length. Now, that is pertinent to companies and institutions that might be for sale or trade in assets. It is particularly difficult to apply to NISFAS because NISFAS doesn't trade its loans in the market, and they're not ordinary commercial loans. They're not loans that you would pass from one institution to another. They have a high social mandate in terms of their purpose. And so there was a challenge as to how this could be done to actually meet with the requirement of IAS 39, which is the International Accounting Standard, and substantiate that objectivity. Not an easy task. Secondly, the 2010 financials did not correctly account for interest over the life of the loan in terms of GRAP 9, and only started accruing interest when the loans began repayment. And this was an issue that we discovered during the review as well, in reviewing the financials and looking at the yield on the book. And the practice had been at NISFAS to only include what they regarded as prudent in the current financial statements, which has a measure of justification, but did not comply with this particular standard. And so you would have a build-up of interest, because from the time the student actually takes out the loan, that interest starts to run, which is something which has recently been changed by way of policy amendment, and that interest would build up. And at the point where the student began to repay, all of that interest would be catapulted into the income statement. Thirdly, NISFAS was unable to justify on verifiable scientific grounds how the debtors were impaired. There was a significant impairment exercise that was undertaken preceding year end, which was initiated via the Ministerial Review Committee when it came to the attention of the committee that there were issues in the loan book that required a revaluation of the book. For example, I'll get to it in a moment, interest had been allowed to run in excess of what is referred to as the induplum rule, which is a common law rule, but now enshrined in the National Credit Act. And so the minister, on the 12th of December of 2009, requested that management value the loan book, which was then at about $10.5 billion in terms of nominal value, and provide a more realistic assessment of what the book was truly worth. However, as that rolled into the year-end process, the auditors the reasons for the impairments were absent, and the auditors found that unacceptable. It's not that the judgments were necessarily incorrect, but unsubstantiated from an audit perspective. If we could just go back, to the previous slide. In addition, NISFAS, as part of this, wrote off $589 million worth of interest. Now, that was interest that was being earned on loans that were being serviced, and NISFAS could not properly justify why that was necessary, and so that formed part of the reasons for the disclaimer. Thank you. There were quite a number of mechanical problems with the preparation of the numbers. There was interest which was incorrectly calculated on a system of about $181 million. And this was finger trouble. Had to do with the incorrect setting of dates in the extraction of the numbers for the year end. And also reconciliation differences which couldn't be substantiated of $42 million. For these reasons, which the Auditor General summarized, decided to disclaim the end-of-year financials for NSFAS. But underlying this was a systemic issue which has to be mentioned as well. It came to the attention of the external auditors very late in the audit that the loan management system, which had been in existence and use for, I think, some 11, 12 years, was dealing with the appropriation of student or debtor repayments incorrectly. And what would happen is that a student would make a payment, and rather than being set off against the accrued interest, which would be the way to do it, it is being set off against the capital amount first, rather than interest first. That has the effect of benefiting students, because your capital runs down faster than what it should, and therefore your interest is lower than what it would normally be. So when I get to the next couple of slides, that's a very important point to remember, because a lot of what has had to be done in preparation for the 2011 year end focused on this and some of the consequences of this systemic deficiency has filtered through into the financial statement as well. Just to highlight some of the key interventions that were undertaken for the 2011 year end, I think the chairman has said enough about the reconstituted board and the executive committee. There was considerable debate in management circles in this phase as to how long would be required to work out of the disclaimed audit opinion. And that centered on the valuation of the loan book and how that could be achieved, comparison to international examples, reference points, etc. The audit committee was of the firm view that no matter how complex this was or how challenging, we could not find ourselves in a situation as an entity where this disclaimer rolled on for the period that management was requesting, which was 3 years. This would be the fair period to get this issue resolved. That it had to be done within the existing year, and that an appeal for a three-year approach had to be changed to a one-year approach and to meet compliance by the end of March 2011. Much of, I think, the difficulties that followed in the relationship with the board and management centered around this future view and the vision and how this could be achieved or not within the time frame. We had to second resources into the finance department to deal with the very technical issues I've mentioned to you. An actuarial valuation of the loan book was undertaken on a multidisciplinary basis using accountants and actuaries to meet the accounting standards requirements, and also analyze the data going back to 1991 in terms of the book's historic loss experience, which covered by this stage, as you can see by the dates, a number of economic cycles. Management had begun a process of trying to reconstitute the loan book amortization. In other words, to be able to rectify on a separate data exercise what the correct attribution of interest was per loan, and that had to be completed. However, it was complicated by the fact that preparation for that exercise required a validation of the underlying data in order for it to be valid for accounting purposes. In the prior year, management had made a provision, a substantial provision, for what was termed data anomalies in the book. The audit committee was particularly unhappy that by the end of the calendar year 2010, there was nothing that had happened which could defend the underlying data as to its veracity to substantiate what was previously a declaration of anomalies. And an independent data verification team from one of the firms of accountants was involved, and all that data had to be verified and paired off across all those years between the loan system that was and the new database that is. The audit committee also, seeing that only 52% of the budget was spent at the end of December, asked for a full review of all expenditure in the pipeline, what it was that was the remaining budget was going to be spent on, a number of fairly large acquisitions, purchases, and so forth were identified over the 500,000 rand limit, and a full procurement review got underway. One of the items involved a forensic investigation, the others an orderly internal audit review. And following the results of that review, which confirmed that there was irregular expenditure, we then initiated a second round of investigations into all amounts falling within certain limits and declared further amounts as irregular, following which the Auditor General took the exercise even further and found even more. We'll get to that in a moment. I think I've explained sufficiently the actuarial valuation, but just to give you an idea of the extent of the exercise, there were over 180 million lines of transactions that had to be dealt with. 810,000 debtors in the system and 1.6 million loans. The model on the server took 5 days to run. So if something had to be amended or changed, it required another 5 days to run again to get to the end answer. So a significant challenge in getting the year-end numbers ready for input into the financial accounting system. The output of this exercise was that we quantified that about 77.8 million in value of credit balances were probably due to students who had overpaid their loans because of the in duplum error. So in the financial year end, we verified that and provision has been made for the refunding of about 34,000 students who overpaid their loans. Students who benefited from the fact that their repayments were set up against capital first, because it would have benefited some. The board took a decision not to ask them to repay that portion, and that students that were prejudiced would be refunded, and that's the number that you see in front of you today. And the next slide, please. We've skipped a slide. The Auditor General expressed a view about the board and about management that the board did not exercise adequate oversight of the appointment of service providers to rectify the end of year challenges from the financial perspective. What happened under great pressure. It happened very, very late, and in fact almost shipwrecked the current financial year end. The actuarial consultants made a number of errors in their calculations, which was nothing more than finger trouble, and it's because of the tremendous pressures that they were working under to try and meet the PFMA deadlines in terms of handover to the AG. And so the AG said that the service providers were appointed too late, the technical aspects were not started timely, which resulted in misstatements, and there was supply chain management failure resulting in irregular expenditure. That the accounting officer, as a member of management, did not take steps to address the irregular expenditure, that no proper guidance, training to staff and supply chain management was done, and also commented on the growing vacancies at the entity. We've just listed there, out of the financial statements, the key irregular expenditure items. Those are the third parties that were party to those transactions. Then there were also an aggregation of findings which had to do with non-compliance with obtaining tax certificates, preferential procurement policy framework adherence. And that stretched back prior to the 2011 year end as well. As you see, there's an opening balance there of 25 million. We can move on. As we believe is our duty, not only were those instances investigated, there are disciplinary hearings that have been conducted for all management involved in those in the procurement processes. Independent adjudication has been part of that. A supply chain management officer has been appointed, but that supply chain management unit, which is necessary, is still some way of being fully resourced. The automation of the purchase order system, there was a manual runaround that was possible by filling up manual purchase orders. To what extent any of the expenditure rather than the processes can be condoned. And the audit of potential fruitless and wasteful expenditure in the irregular finding. Of also concern to the Auditor General is the state of information technology within the entity, which has been some time coming. There's no Chief Information Officer, and recruitment is underway for that post. No formal information technology governance, no formal IT project or risk management framework, no formally approved disaster recovery and business continuity planning. And whilst there is a business continuity plan, disaster recovery should something happen to a national entity like this, it would take something in the order of a few weeks to get the full complement of the staff and systems up and running. And then the remedial action and plans to remedy the deficiencies in this area. It came to our attention during the end of year audit that there was a case of possible misrepresentation by one of the employees, although not senior. Had a important task in the organization around compliance. And we discovered inadvertently and then had to investigate, had to initiate a forensic investigation into circumstances surrounding possible misrepresentation to third party suppliers. The employee was suspended once the initial interviews had been conducted. And a disciplinary hearing is scheduled for 19th and 20th of October. We were relieved to find, after we had followed a no-regrets approach and taken every possible measure to make sure that nothing, no financial loss occurred, that there was no harm suffered by NSFAS, and nor any pending harm.
Yeah, Paul. Paul Slack is going to lead us in this section.
Thank you, Chair. As you've heard, I was tasked with being the project manager of the year-end audit. I started sometime in April, and as Stephen has said, I resigned from the audit committee, where I had started hearing about some of the issues at NSFAS, and I was a fairly new kid on the block in terms of the audit committee. I resigned from that and then joined as acting chief financial officer to try and get through the audit. And I picked up some of the issues that had already been started to be addressed. We'll just quickly give you a brief idea of what it is that we do. During 2010, we distributed nearly 3.7 billion rand to nearly 211,000 students. That was already 17% more than the year before. So NISFAS is a growing organization, both in terms of numbers that we deal with and value that we deal with. Since we started, we've disbursed something like 19 billion rand. In 2011 alone, that 3.7 billion from the prior year has now grown to 5.5 billion. And there are a number of different categories of funding that come through to us. So it's not just one bucket of money that comes and we disperse it. There are a number of different categories, some relating to final year students who haven't got their bursaries, and there's a fund for that. Some people with historical debt relief, there's a fund for that, and there's now an RDP fund, I understand, that is coming through. And each of those have their own rules and conditions relating to when a student qualifies or when anybody qualifies to get that loan. So it's important to understand that the growth in the organization, as I said, both in terms of numbers and in terms of value, but also in terms of complexity, because each category of funding has its own rules that apply. Generally speaking, if a student gets through the system fairly quickly, we'll convert 40% of their loan to a bursary. So I will give you a long explanation in a minute why our book is very different to what transaction value in our loan system, but I'll go into that in a while. Last year, in the audited year, it cost us nearly 2 billion rand, that write-off. And in fact, that number, the bigger that number, the better we're doing our job as a country. And I think it needs to be noted that. So 15% of the loan book last year was converted to bursaries for students that actually got through the system and passed. The balance sheet is in your pack at page 60 in our annual report. A very brief indication of what's going on in our balance sheet. At the end of the year, we had investments in bank account balances of about 791 million, and I've just in brackets behind that indicated which is current investments in cash. One might ask, why do we have so much money in the bank? We have a policy whereby the recoveries on student loans are only reapplied to additional student loans in the following year. So there's a lag, and that was nearly 630 million last year. And we also had some, if you see in our balance sheet, we also had some deferred income. In other words, income that has already been received but is only applied or asked for by the donor to be applied in the following year. So there are reasons why we would have investments in bank. The prepayment figure of nearly 300 million, that figure relates to the beginning of a financial year when students enroll. Many of the students, when they're enrolling at university, don't have sufficient money to register. So what happens is we give an advance of up to 30% of the allocation for a particular university. We pay that up front, and that it gets accounted for down the line. Now, because of the difference in timing between an academic year and our financial year, which is 3 months into the next calendar year, we have this element of money that we've paid out to universities that hasn't yet been accounted for, but will be accounted for as their registration process is finalized, and that's what that 300 million is. The real character in our balance sheet is the student loans. I mean, all the other figures are in millions. This is in billions. We've got 5 billion rands worth of student loans on our balance sheet. And you heard Stephen mention something about 10 billion, and currently on our loan management system, our book is sitting at 12 billion. And I'm going to have to explain how we get from 12 billion to 5 billion in the balance sheet, which I'll do with pleasure in the next few slides. We carry some fixed assets at 12.8 million. That's really not a big number for an organization like this. That's all our furniture and our computer equipment and so on. And seriously, in with respect to the figures that we're showing there for the loan book, that kind of pales into insignificance. We have payables of 53 million in our balance sheet. That's normal everyday payments. We've got a full listing of those on page 83 of our financial statements. There's 17 million of our normal payments. That includes things like the leave provision, the bonus provision, all normal accounting things. There's a 20 million provision payable for the Fundisa Fund, and amounts due to institutions, which is other universities, that's money that we're collecting on their behalf with a contract with them, but at any point in time they can ask for their money, so there's about another 17 million there, and that's how that figure is made up. And Stephen's already given an indication of what the credit balances are that manifested as a result of the actuarial exercise that we did. That's 77 billion, million. 77 million is the same figure that Stephen mentioned earlier. In terms of our expenditure, what does it cost us to run this organization? Our operational expenses last year were about 57 million. When I say last year, that's the 2011 financial year, and you'll see that salaries makes up close to half of what we do. We had some significant audit expenditure in the year last year. It needs to be pointed out that that 6 million rand audit is not necessarily a normal year. We had, as you heard, a couple of forensic exercises. Obviously, with the turnaround strategy, we had, because of the work we were doing and trying to get out of the disclaimer and get an unqualified audit report, there was a lot more involvement with our auditors. We had the actuarial exercise itself, which is under that particular heading as well. And our own auditors, the external auditors that did our books, had to involve their own actuaries, and actuaries are not cheap, so that's to a large extent why our audit fees ended up where they are. It's not normal, and it should be less in the next year. The communication, 6.4 million, that's our attempt to find people beforehand to market our services, to advise people that NIFAS exists, and it's a significant number. It's 10% of our budget. And going to stay that way for the next budget year. We've allowed for similar levels. And then the rest of the stuff, what I did there was just highlight the things that are more or less around a million or more. And it's all the stuff that an organization, you would expect from an organization like this. We have Metrofile, we have mountains of paper that we have to store, and that's nearly a million rand a year. We post statements once a quarter to the students. You heard that the 810,000 students in the system, that postage costs us a lot. The stationery that we print on for getting all of these statements out, 1.7 million rand, and the telephones, a million rand. So those are all operating expenses, and they're all pretty much where you'd expect them to be. Right, so I mentioned that we have a loan management system of 12.2 billion. And yet my balance sheet only reflects 5 billion, and we have the 7 billion rand difference. Now, this can get a little technical. I hope I managed to explain it. I needed to explain it in layman's terms so that I could understand it. We were now able to substantiate to the Auditor General, you heard earlier, that there were issues in the prior year that didn't have scientific basis or justification for how some of the write-offs were done. We feel we're now able to do that. Through the actuarial exercise that was done. We tend to be pretty good at awarding funds. As I said, we've pushed a lot of money out of the system. We tend to be pretty good at administering our loans and running the debtors book, and we charged 536 million in interest last year. One of the weaknesses, and something that will need to be addressed, is that we're not as good at finding and chasing students or debtors and recovering the money from them. We only recovered 5% of our loan book last year, and this is an area we need to address. Interestingly enough, recent acts of Parliament will make that more difficult for us, but that's the challenge which we will rise to. We now can't go to people and deduct from their salaries without positive consent from them. Previously, we were able to do that. You may know about Section 23 of the NIFAS Act that has recently been repealed. But work has already started in that area, and we're confident that we'll be able to improve on that number. So the real reasons, there are about 7 reasons why we may have 12 billion on our books, but only 5 billion on our balance sheet. The first reason is we don't know if the debtor will pay us. Our rules in terms of NIFAS, we exist to give loans to people that shouldn't get loans. That's why we're there. The kinds of people that we're giving loans to would not get a loan from a bank. So it's a different kind of client, it's a different kind of debtor, and we don't know if that debtor will ever pay us. The fact of the matter is they only have to start paying us, if they get a job when they exit the system. Now, they could exit either as a graduate or as a dropout. The likelihood of a dropout getting a job is obviously less than a graduate, but not only that, they have to earn 30,000 rand a year first before they qualify to have to pay us back at all. And on top of that 30,000 is a starting point. It works from a sliding scale up. So it's conceivable that a student who's been in the system for 5 years and perhaps has received loans for 5 years, exits the system, earns 30,000 rand, and the value of the loans and the interest chargeable on that loan exceeds the amount that they'll be repaying us every year. Even though we're charging a very low interest rate. So it's conceivable, first of all, that they won't pay, and it's conceivable that when they do pay, it's not enough. And that's just the nature of our book. So over a 20-year period, we've developed a pattern of on average, on actuarial summaries of what, how many people will pay, and we will be able, we can factor that in. So if it's if there's a point at some time when the student doesn't pay us, we factor that in. We reflect that there's an impairment, that a certain percentage of the students are not going to pay us, and therefore the loan will be at a lower value. Having said that, point number two, we don't know when the student will pay. So when the student drops out or graduates, they exit the system. There's a couple of reasons why we don't know when they'll pay. First of all, they might not find a job. Second of all, if they do find a job, they might not earn 30,000 rand. Third of all, if they do find a job, it might be in the informal sector, and perhaps they don't pay tax, and we can't find them through the traditional means. And also, we get cases where we just lose track of them. They're difficult to find. Maybe left the country. So there's another reason why we can't be sure that we will receive 100% of them, of the student loan. The third reason, I call that the time value of money. It should be obvious in terms of purchasing power parity that if we lend somebody 10,000 rand now, but our expectation is that we will only receive it in a few years' time, let's say 3 years' time, that 10,000 rand to be reflected on my balance sheet now isn't 10,000 rand because I'm only going to get it 3 years down the line. It's going to be some lesser value. We have to discount that back from what we expect in the future to today's value, and the discounting rate that we use is the risk-free rate, which during the course of the 2011 year was 8.5%. So in other words, we're saying we lose 8.5% a year because that's the value that's eroded just through time. When I get my 10,000 back in that particular example, it will be worth 8.5% less for 3 years, so 24% less. So the value of the 12 billion will be something less because it takes that time value of money into account. The next reason is still talking about the time value of money to some extent. It's the differential interest rates. The interest that we charge on an ISFAS loan is pegged at 80% of repo on the 1st of April in any 1 year. Currently, or for the period certainly at 2011 audit, the interest we're charging is 4.4%. Now that is very low. Now, the differential interest rate, the effect that that has on the value of the loan is if I'm pushing the loan up by 4.4% a year, but as I've just described earlier with the discounting, if I'm pulling it back down by 8.5% a year, it stands to reason that up 4.5%, down 8.5%, I'm just losing money. I get parochial about it. It's not my money, but we're just losing money. So the difference between these two interest rates just means that the value is going to come down. And once again, it's another reason why the 12 billion became 5 billion. Now, there's a little curveball in that, and that is if the student loan has been outstanding for quite a long time and they've reached the in-duplum level, in other words, the value of the interest equals the value of the loan, the law says, common law says, you're not allowed to charge any more interest. So at that point, I'm not pushing the loan up by 4.4%, but I'm still pulling it down by 8.5%. So that even exacerbates the differential in value even more. The actuaries then factor in death and disability. It's a fact, unfortunately, that some people are going to die. Young people die for a variety of reasons. And the actuaries affected in the South African actuarial tables to our loan book. And on 810,000 debtors, it's most likely that some of those people are going to die. We can't tell you who, but we can certainly put a factor in for that. And that reduces the value of the loan book because we don't chase dead people for money. We don't go and pursue their estates for repayment. Then obviously one of the biggest reasons why it's different, I mentioned earlier that anything up to 40% of that loan can be converted to a bursary if the student is successful in academic studies. And just take a 10,000 loan, if we could pick a particular student and say that within 3 years that student is going to qualify, we would know straight away that the real value of that 10,000 is in fact only 6,000 because we are going to write 40% off. So that's another reason why the 12 billion comes down to 5 billion. And then as a final point, we have this cut-off point. We over a 20-year period, over 810,000 debtors, have built up an enormous repository of repayment information. We know how many students and the nature of the student or the nature of the debts that are going to be paid. And we put in a cut-off point and say that if the debtor hasn't started repaying us within 10 years, it's unlikely that they're going to repay. And at that point, we impair that loan in full. In other words, we just pretend that we're not going to receive it. We basically write it off. Now, those are actuarial factors that are applied. I would love to be able to sit here and tell you that I worked through the actuarial model line by line myself. I have no idea how they got from there to there, but I know why they got from there to there, and that's what I've been trying to explain now. I can say that it was fully audited by our internal auditors. The data was fully audited by internal auditors, and the actuarial assumptions, we got our actuaries, our auditors' actuaries, we got involved with our consultant actuaries at as early a stage as possible. In fact, one of the first things I did when I got there was to put the two of them in a room and bored myself to death listening to them, but trying to understand what they were talking about and getting the loan, the concept of this process, these seven variations or variables, put into their models and got them all to understand what it was we were trying to achieve.
Chairperson, in taking us to concluding this presentation, I'm going to invite to Nathan Johnston, who is our chairperson of the Finance Committee. I want to thank Stephen and Paul for their part. You might notice that we have developed passion of this work, and sometimes we think that this money is in our pocket and therefore we cannot let it go at any given moment. So this is how we feel about students, poorest of the poor out there. Nathan.
Chairperson, thank you. Chairperson of the committee, honourable members, I am one of the six board members who remained after December 2010. I was appointed to the board in July 2008, was appointed as chairperson of the Finance Committee at the end of July 2010. So I speak as a member of the previous board, knowing a lot of the history that Paul referred to, but that Stephen also took us through and the chairperson took us through, and I speak as a member of the new board, knowing what it has taken to get NSFAS to where it is today. The functions of the Finance Committee are defined in the NSFAS Act, and the Finance Committee is chiefly responsible for advising the board on financial management, which includes the raising of funds, loan recovery, and investment of repayments. As Paul has pointed out, repayments from students in a particular financial year are held in investment and are only allocated to student awards in the following financial year, and so that money has to be invested. The Finance Committee also monitors and reports on performance. So the quarterly performance reports that are submitted to the Department of Higher Education and Training are scrutinized by the Finance Committee and then go to the board with a recommendation. And we monitor the and report on the annual performance reports. I'd like to move to the annual performance report and refer the members to page 23 of the annual report. And on page 23, the six strategic goals of NSFAS are outlined. If we look at the three strategic goals that are on the screen in front of us, we will see that those three goals relate specifically to the funding that is available. So, raising money, distributing the money, and the internal processes of administering the student awards. As Paul has pointed out, we are good at the second one, very good at giving away money, we're not so good at the first goal. So if we turn over to pages 24 and 25 in the annual report, the printed annual report, the first strategic goal is the expanding of the pool of funds available for disbursement of student loans and bursaries, and we will see that most of the performance targets for the first strategic goal were not met in the 2010-2011 financial year. In particular, there were serious issues relating to the statement runs for the recovery of loans, and so most of the performance targets in that year were not met. If we turn to pages 26 and 27, this is the one that we are good at, and if you scan down the annual performance results, then we see that all those targets were met. And that just underlines the point that Paul made. We are good at giving money away, we're not so good at recovering the money. If we go to pages 28 to pages 31, where we have strategic goal 3, of the annual performance targets, the results column show us that 3 targets were met, 4 targets were not met, and 2 targets were partly met. And again, this is an indication of some of the issues that we are having to deal with in terms of the internal performance of the organization to meet and to deliver on its mandate. If we'd like just move to the next slide. The remaining 3 strategic objectives relate very much to internal operations, so how NSFAS organizes itself, how it goes about its work, how it communicates with stakeholders, and what research it undertakes to inform the effective utilization of funds. Paul referred to the operating budget, indicated that just over 40% of the total expenditure, 57 million rand, was spent on salaries. A significant amount of money, approximately 10% of the budget, spent on communications. And so one can see how critically important these strategic goals are. We spend a lot of money in these areas, and so we better ensure that the money we spend is effective. So if we look at strategic goal 4 on pages 34 and 35 of the annual report, which relates to the quality of internal management and operations, then only 1 of the 4 performance targets were met. 3 of the performance targets were only partly met for a variety of reasons that are outlined in the column for the reasons for the variances. On communication, strategic goal 5, 4 of the targets were not met, 2 of the targets were partly met, and 6 of the targets were met, so a 50-50 split in terms of about 10% of the budget in the 2010-2011 financial year. Strategic goal 6, which deals with research, understanding the nature of the higher education sector, understanding student needs, understanding the patterns, changing patterns within the sector, and using that information to direct the utilization of funds more effectively to meet the strategic goals and to provide advice to the minister on matters related to student financial aid. That strategic goal is from page 40 to page 43 in the annual report, and we will see there that 2 targets were not met, 4 targets were partly met, and only 4 of the targets were met. So again, in that financial year, critical function that NSFAS has to undertake, fewer than 50% of the targets were met. We could move to the last slide. So given that an underperforming organization in terms of what we have seen in the performance report, in terms of its strategic goals and objectives. A new board that has been tasked by the minister and the department to bring about a turnaround strategy and to ensure that NSFAS is able to meet its mandate and do what it was established to do in the most effective and efficient way as possible. The board is in the process of developing comprehensive policies and plans to improve operational efficiency and to lay the foundation for a smooth transition to a new student-centered system. In his introductory remarks, the chairperson, in his report on the board itself, the chairperson of the board indicated that the board has made a very deliberate policy decision that the money will follow the student. And so the basis of what we do is that the student is at the center of the system and everything we do needs to be directed at the student. This includes new IT infrastructure systems and operations, which includes the acquisition and implementation of a new loan management system. Stephen referred to some of the issues that have been identified in the loan management system. That's about 10 or 11 years old, is not fit for purpose, is not able to take NSFAS to where it needs to be, is not able to provide the sort of information that is required for NSFAS to continue receiving unqualified audit opinions. And so we will be procuring and implementing a new loan management system. The loan and bursaries administration systems changing to a student-centered focus, whereas at the moment we report on utilization per institution on a quarterly basis. So our focus is really on the institution. Going into the future, we're going to have to report on the number of students who are assisted. And the loans and bursary administration system, including the IT infrastructure and the operations, have to be geared to do that. In the finance division, we are moving from what I call an event management approach, where a quarterly report is an event and audit is an event, to a process management approach, where we put processes in place. There are daily processes, there are weekly processes, there are annual processes for finance, and this includes simple things like ensuring that for the first time in August this year, NSFAS produced monthly management accounts on loans and bursaries administration and on administration. And the finance committee has received two sets of monthly management accounts, has made its input and advised on refinements to the reporting process. We are putting policies and plans in place for more effective credit management, including debt recovery. Paul referred to the repeal of Section 23 of the NSFAS Act. We have put a project in place to ensure that we obtain positive consent from every debtor for whom there is a payroll deduction. Improved audit and risk management, human resources management, a complete overhaul of the NSFAS human resources policies has been done, and new policies are ready to be presented to the board for consideration and approval. And then in terms of communications, where we spend approximately 10% of our budget, an approach to communications that is targeted on the student and that is effective and that ensures that students are able to access the funding that they need to get into universities, to get into FET colleges, that they have information about that before they register, and that they know where they need to go to access that. Thank you.
Chairperson, this is our end of the presentation. This is the annual report of NSFAS and we're presenting to you. We are more than willing to take questions and comments as the board members of NSFAS. And thank you very much for your invitation.
Thank you very much, honorable members. We have got about 30 minutes for us to conclude this business. That includes asking questions, commentary, and responses. Any questions? I'll start this final session, and then we'll follow. Yeah, follow, then we'll come just that way. Short to the point, and understanding the limitations of time, because we're still going to receive another presentation. Let's draw in on the key aspects of the presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would like to congratulate those responsible for the clean audit report, the unqualified audit report, although there were still some issues with the AG. But it has come at a very high price, it seems. In terms of money, it has come up at a very high price. I see the external audit fees have almost trebled. I see the consultancy fees have gone up 70%. Business development services went up by a factor of something like 8. Travel and subsistence went up by more than 50%. Internal audit fees doubled. It just seems to me as if, you know, I understand they've pulled out everything because NSFAS has had a history of unhealthy audit reports. But it just seems to me as if it has now required a lot of external capacity that had to be bought in and brought in to just satisfy the requirements of the Auditor General. But there's more to a business than just a clean audit report. And I don't want to underplay that. We're very happy with the fact that you've been able to present us with such a report. But what I've picked up sometimes in things what you've shared with us and also between the lines, that there has been a terrible loss of expertise from the organization, a high staff turnover, that there even still today exists a high vacancy rate, especially when it comes to senior positions, that the position of the CEO has been vacant since first week in April, and it still is. It seems to me as if there's also a lack of continuity at board level. And some of those here today you know, have been part of previous boards or previous years' boards. For quite a while, there's been very poor attendance of board meetings. It seems to me that there's also some very slow disciplinary processes going. I see here in the annual report there's reference to a forensic audit that was done, but I do not hear today of any disciplinary action being concluded. It seems to me as if, you know, 6 months after the end of this financial year, those processes are still hanging in the air, so to say. It also seems to me as if we've got a very unhealthy involvement of board members in managerial issues. And the Auditor General, I think, has also referred to that. And I know it may have been born out of need, but I do not see that situation being reversing back to what should be a normal governance versus management relationship. And sir, we're 6 months into this year. I'm afraid that next year, when we get the next statements, that some of these issues will reappear, and that we will have problems with that. We have an organization that relies heavily on IT systems, but what I've just heard is that the IT systems that is being used is not meeting the needs of the organization. And Chairperson, as far as I know from my contact with students, it is also as if NSFAS is something very far off while they're studying. I don't see any communication with students saying, you're our client, we're not rendering statements, because we're not charging you interest, but know that, you know, be aware, here is NSFAS, we're waiting for you. I almost want to say, like, you know, Papa, wacht vir jou. You know, one day, when you finish with your studies, remember, you have a certain commitment towards us. There's also a psychological aspect to managing that.
We're taking them along with the, on our visit to play.
So, but this, debt collection, sir, is also a psychological thing. It's not only a technical thing. And I do not see any reference or any improvement of the systems to that. So I would like the board members to comment on this. Am I wrong in my perception that we're sitting with an enormously important organization, important for the students, important for this country, but also important for the taxpayers in terms of the amounts of money that are not managed and administered in an orderly way. And I feel very uncomfortable hearing what have been presented to us today. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Also, just our congratulations. I note that they jumped a step, as it were. Organizations usually move from disclaimer to qualified and then unqualified. But somehow you just move disclaimer, unqualified. Our congratulations. Unless I've missed it, the issue of disciplinary processes. I think there is one that is being disclosed here of somebody of misstatement. But then when you look at matters raised by the auditor, people are amounts of 10,000 to half a million, where they were supposed to attract three quotes, they haven't done that. Amounts higher than half a million, where people are supposed to take it through the tender process. I want to hear that people have been taken through some form of disciplinary process here, and what outcomes there are. And somewhere when you talk about discipline, you're talking about senior managers have been disciplined. Unless the assumption is that you don't have misconduct at junior level, because I thought you'd say offender or people who are suspected, not only at a certain level. Help me. And I guess something to do with my poor arithmetic, I guess. In your operational expenses, personnel costs are taking 40%. Now, that's not the overall 40% of the whole budget. And I'm trying to think, because if we were in the CITAS and others, we would have said there is a 10% rule of administration at worst to 12.5%. Now, I want to understand, if I were to use the whole now, what percentage is your operational expenses of the whole? Of the whole. The other thing is that I hear you are lamenting the repeal of Section 23, and look, my condolences. It was an illegal thing. But I'm worried, Chairperson, whether they are not substituting an illegal thing with another illegal thing. Because they've just said here that when it comes to recovery, they're talking about getting positive consent. And I'm just saying this because I want assurance that they are not doing that. Because we know of organizations that have tried to tie students. In other words, when you take a loan, you already sign a consent. Something like that. To say in case I default. Because that's another illegality. I mean, you get this consent at the time that you have a judgment. And you actually get a garnishee order. What kind of positive this? Because my understanding is that to get some deduction from somebody's salary, you need a garnishee order. I don't know of any other legal. Okay. And then the other thing is that maybe I'm asking the wrong person, but I really want to understand, it will help me, possibly other members, when you talk about rotating service providers, and I see one of them identified, I would be comfortable if you say little whatever. But if you say SA Post Office must be rotated, I say, wait a bit. There is only one post office in South Africa. I'm talking about here, this is a state entity. So we can even consider leaving it to go and get private ones. I want clarification. Maybe we may take, depending on the answer, we may have to go back to the Auditor General and say, excuse us, what are you saying? Yeah, well. I don't think they will be cheap.
Thanks, Chair. I view the Chief Executive as a critical member of the executive. How then does this appointment get delayed to December? This one, I'm not necessarily wanting an explanation or a response now, if you don't have to respond to it. But there is an issue of the difference from 12 billion to 5 billion. It appears as if an explanation was given to the Auditor General and it was accepted. But I missed it in the presentation. My last issue is 15 to 18% vacancies. What is the impact of this on delivery? Thanks.
Chairperson, thank you. I don't have the background of an accountant, but I'm going to ask a few questions. I need an answer as to, I need to understand the period for the unqualified report, financial year 2010-2011, is the time that the previous CEO was the manager. Does he get the credit for what happened here? Because it's during his time that this unqualified report was obtained. So I need to understand this. How come? The Director General mentioned initially, he referred to poor decisions. Now, I would ask, if this is one of the poor decisions that was made, why did the minister appoint a board member and then fire the board member within a year? I'm specifically referring to Professor Fitzpatrick, who is the Deputy Vice Chancellor of WITS Finance and Operations. He's also a well-known author in the public finance field. Did they replace this kind of intellectual capital in the board? Or have we lost it? Why? Was this one of the poor decisions that were made? Then I also need to know, what has the board done new or differently from what management, or what happened under the management of the previous CEO? Surely this person would have had an action plan as to how to respond to the disclaimer. You've mentioned a few things in your document. If you compare the action plan or the obvious action plan as to what happened, what the new people did, I need to know what is the difference and what did they do then, differently or new? Then on page 14, unfortunately the presentation doesn't have page numbering, but on page 14, audit findings, I think it was Mr. Smith referred to the accounting officer. Is that a printing error or are you referring here to the accounting authority? It's either the officer or the authority. I'll read the bullet management and then the sub-bullet accounting officer did not take steps to address irregular expenditure. Then on slide 16, you refer in the first bullet to disciplinary hearings of all management involved, etc. What were the outcomes of these disciplinary hearings? A final question on the 18th slide. You referred to misrepresentation. What exactly did this misrepresentation entail? Thank you.
Thanks a lot. And of course, one would like to join those who congratulated you for getting to unqualified financial report after having been somewhat embarrassed by the claim. So the first from which I would relate to the independent data verification process and the institution that you engaged to look at the loan book. And how long did that take, and whether that's credible, is reliable by now. Raising it here because at some point you would find that within NSF you wouldn't have a lot of systems. They wouldn't even be able to track their students. Like now, I'm not sure if you are able to say these ones dropped out, these ones qualified, and so on, and where are these people? Yes, it's difficult to tell at times when they're not necessarily within the employ, but at least because you're supposed to be in charge of this entire system and your clientele, it should be possible to have some information at your fingertips as to exactly what is going on. And I will relate this chat to also the issue between NSF transfers and the cycle for budgeting by universities. Because at some point, universities will claim that they're not getting money in time. It's as if your own cycle of transferring and their own intake and distribution or allocation to students did not really align. And whether that has been resolved. The other chair is that who's exactly in charge of these allocations? Because you'll have students at some point when we meet them arguing that they're given blank forms to complete by universities. And to us, it's actually illegal to say you qualify but just complete here. Yeah? They will sort everything else later on without you. And you are part of this contract, but you are sidelined in terms of what to fill in. You are only told later that because we had limited resources, it will be 4,000 for you as opposed to 20,000 and so on. So students don't know at the point of signing that form how much they will even get. But the issue here is exactly who's in charge. Under such circumstances, where do students go? Do they argue with the university management? Do they come to you? Where do they actually go? I'm not sure if you haven't got these kind of difficulties by students. The other question is, you have taken a decision to disestablish the research and the communications body or unit. What was the reason? Is it no longer required or will constitute it anew? What is the process there? What informed that decision and whether its work has not been done? Chair, the last one is that I have seen members here as well referring to the supplementary financial or financials by you, which haven't been audited. It's unaudited info. To what extent can we rely on that? when was it to be audited? Or it doesn't necessarily have to be audited, but it should be for public consumption. Because my view is that anything that may not be audited probably shouldn't be shared with us at this level. Because we'll rely on that information, and it may be misleading. It was never verified or double-checked by the authorities that NEDAC has done that. And I want that response. The very last, is this compiled on the basis of GRAP, as in the accounting principle, or you still going to ensure that you follow or you comply with that format, the manner in which you prepared your financials, particularly without your CEO, your CFO, whether the executive does have the financial proficiency to deal with this, because now I think some of you, unless if you relied more on consultants, probably it's not in-house necessarily done, but it means at your level, it means there are those who must be able to, or are so familiar or have this proficiency in terms of competency to know whether statements are being prepared well on your behalf or not. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Professor. I think much has been said regarding the strides that have been made to get an unqualified audit, and I think we all share that sentiment. Chairperson, mine would this is the 2010-11 statement. My question would be, when did this turnaround strategy start? So I would take it that this already started within last year in order to get this unqualified. And I look at that in terms of when the assessment was done, which was in October last year, members that resigned in December, and the posts been filled in January. So when, just try and bring it together. Somewhere I'm a bit lost. My next question would be around the refunding of the 34,000 students. When will this take place? Are they already informed? Will it be on a once-off, or will it be over a period of time? And coupled to that, the losses in the system that was used previously, is that taken up in the 7 million? That was spoken about, I think it was the 12.2 versus the brought down to the 5.2. If that is taken up, and what particular amount we're looking at the chairperson, which would then be absorbed by NSFAS. The policies and procedures that are referred to on the last slide, when do we hope to have these policies, or does NSFAS hope to have these policies and procedures in place? And would this address some of these policies, address, or also taking into mind that each institution is autonomous? We know that students being in institution A would not necessarily get the same funding as to a student in institution B, because the policy with that institution would be different. Wouldn't it fact be looking at some type of uniformity so that the formulas are the same, especially when we look at top slicing with institutions? Check. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson of the board, on his introductory remarks, he made mention of the seven functions of the NSFAS board, and I was happy when he said everything should revolve around a student. My first question will be, as NSFAS, I know maybe we'll say we'll shift whatever to the institutions, or, but at the end of it all, it comes back to NSFAS. As to say, why do you want to take the interest of students
of that interest to be of importance, how do we see, how do we avoid the chaos that we usually see at the beginning of the year, where students are really, the way they are treated by some of the institutions, they even sleep on the road just because they want to go and apply. I'm not sure whether it's application or approval or around the issues of NSFAS. How can we make sure that we prevent such things as NSFAS that really it becomes so terrible, as if they want to access these monies, they have to suffer the way they suffer. How can such things be avoided, just to make sure that we take their interest up, as I think one of the things that was said. Again, when you go to the seven functions of NSFAS, one of them is to raise funds. And I don't think that the raising of funds solely is on collecting that collecting from the students. What are other ways of which NSFAS raise funds for this fund, of which the board raise funds for NSFAS? I haven't heard of any, and if so, yeah, if we can be appraised on that one. Chair, another one, around the 34,000 students that still need to be repaid by NSFAS, I'm not sure yet how much is that for those 34 students, and I'm very much interested even on the interest that is generated by those funds that is being owed to those students, as to when you think of repayment, what is it, what are you going to do around the issue of interest, because I think that is what is due to them, whether that thing is going to be considered. When I look at the report again, Chair, yes, I see a number of people, members of the board, resigning, new appointed, and somehow I see even some where, like there's one woman there, where there was a termination of membership. I'm very much interested just to say, let me leave alone the suspension of the CEO, and but when we say we terminate the membership of a board member, what warrant is that? Why do we do that? What is it that you can say after this has happened, then the membership can be terminated? Lastly, Chair, I would also want to speak on the issue of vacancies, where almost everybody has talked of, as to say, really, we would love to see NSFAS also adhering to the call by the president of the 3 month period for any position, for any vacancy to be filled. It's a little bit uncalled for to find that they can wait for almost more than 6 months to fill in the critical vacancies which is happening on the NSFAS. But hopefully by the December that they're promising us, we hope next year are not going to come back having these critical vacancies not being filled. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just to clear the questions that were asked, I must state up front that I respect quite highly Professor Fitzgerald, because he's one of the educated professors around who has made huge contribution in the academia. And I continue to respect him for that. But on this matter of NSFAS, we had a number of sessions with him, starting from June 2010, where we sought to find out the problems that the entire country was encountering in regard to NSFAS that couldn't be justified, that couldn't be explained satisfactorily. And in that meeting, we then agreed that there should be measures put in place to actually attend to these matters. And in 3 months' time, we'll have to meet and evaluate progress. And that meeting of assessment took place in September 2010. It came out there that NSFAS at that stage didn't have any initiative in addressing the question of not having valued the books at fair value at initial recognition, as well as did not correctly account for interest over the life of a loan. So here, we are not dealing with a matter of perception or opinion. We are actually dealing what is prescribed by international accepted accounting standards, as well as GRAP. It's not a thumbsack. The process and how it should be done is prescribed by those standards and requirements in the accounting practice. It's not something that one does generate. The impairment was another question, which at that stage there was not any single proof that the process has begun to address this question. The interest on loans as well, I suppose if I borrow somebody money, I'll be able to determine on the spot that I'll charge this amount of interest and it will be known. Or I will agree upfront that I will not charge interest. I will treat you as just as my makelwane. You'll pay me when you are fine, whether it takes 10 years or so. But if I decide to charge interest, I'll know this is the interest and that's how it is going to accumulate. Now, when we met for assessment, looking at all these matters, including the writing of an interest of more than 500 million, which cannot be explained, I had to take responsibility to brief the minister properly about the state of affairs at NSFAS. And in my opinion, that state of affairs, taking into account that it places at risk the future of thousands and thousands of young people of this country, that at this rate, what is happening there, in 3 years' time, we won't have students anymore. And in my opinion, if we can be able to identify correct skills, this matter can be attended to in 3 months' time. All what is required is to identify right people with right skills. They are in abundance in South Africa. They can come in and do the work. There was nothing personal at all. Hence then, this intervention was actually made. It was purely on those bases. The second point, the member who has left is worried about the staff turnover. This staff turnover at NSFAS is not as a result of accident. At the inception of the board, when I gave them a mandate that I wanted the turnaround to be in 3 months, go out, mobilize whatever resources, but in 3 months, I want to see that there is drastic change here. And one of the things I would like to see, there must be no reward for poor performance. I don't know whether the contestation is that when it has been discovered that 20 million of irregular expenditure, the board members should have just shied and laughed about that and not act to those who are responsible for that and other numbers of other issues of irregularity as been pointed out, and inefficiencies, both from the board that was reconstituted as well as from the management, based purely on bad decisions and relating to the affairs of the National Student Financial Aid Scheme in a laissez-faire approach, whilst it's a matter that has to determine the future and the requisite skills that we want in the country. I think the intervention and the operations that had to be undertaken to stabilize that entity were necessary. And the outcomes are proving that the people who were given this task were the right people to be given it. And they've shown us results within that time period. It's not the work that was done over 12 months, over 3 years, from January 7th of January 2011 to 31st of March. I'm quite accurate. And all the systems that had to attend to impairment, correct calculation of loans, all those were attended from the 7th of January, not before that time. Hence the intervention. It is incorrect, therefore, to make any suggestion that this turnaround took place before the 7th of January 2011. It's factual, it's accurate. We can commission any accountant or any analyst, it will come to the same conclusion. Thank you very much, Chair.
We've exhausted the time which we needed to deal with NSFAS, and I'm aware that we must go to the Council on Habitation. The committee, because maybe it began the meeting at 2 in the afternoon, was not as sharp as I know it to be. I'm certain that they wanted to ask questions, but they became philosophical. They wanted to say, look, you can't fill the position of the CEO because there's a case in a court of law and so on. What's happening? They couldn't ask that. I could hear them ask, but philosophically. But we can't treat that question here. We can't, we know that, but we need a report to appraise us as an oversight committee. What's happening? From whichever party, maybe the CEO, maybe the accounting authority, would be happy to hear that. But we do, on such matters, we'll go to the minister. We hope that it's been processed. I think what must be key for NSFAS is to say that this committee is fully aware of the fact that you are not like a commercial bank. We're aware of that. This committee wants to see more students, particularly from historically disadvantaged backgrounds, receiving funding. We don't want NSFAS giving more money to advantaged universities. That's a worry to us. I mean, they've got huge reserves, but you still give them more money, and then they give a single student in the first year 50,000 rand. And then a student, an investor or vendor, gets 5,000 rand. They call it top slicing because they've got to cut this little money they get amongst 17,000 students. I mean, that's a worry to us. That must be solved. And then what then must happen is that when the auditors come and say, account for the money, then you account for it. To say, yes, we gave this much to this. And as a committee, we're also aware that 40% of people who receive funding end up being dropouts. We know that. It's a national phenomenon that we must tackle. And we are happy also that you mentioned some amount, I think it's 2.something million. The amount that you write off, because it tends to become a bazaar. it is a positive, is a positive development, because those are the ones that pass. In actual fact, that's the only money we appreciate as a committee, because we know that this money was given to those who passed. 1.8 billion, if I'm correct, return of the 40% return off. That's good money. As a bank, now as a, I don't know whether I'll be a bank or a banker when I'm sitting here, we will say this 1.8 billion is what we appreciate. The rest of the money we have, we're throwing into, is a game of trying to improve a society. We don't know whether this person is going to die, to pass, to fail, not get a job, but don't be worried about that. Those dynamics as a world and as a country we know. What matters to us is that we should be able to say, when we have written off an amount, it is to each man who passed away, it is to each man who could not pay until being too old to work, and all that, those dynamics. So we would like you to have the proper systems in place. We would like you to, I think Dabiru Kogo summarized for the committee on one thing. You can't, chairperson, come here and say we're going to act against people in the future of the committee about things that had occurred a year ago. We don't usually accept that here, just that it's in the afternoon. Because in that instance, we'll go deeper and say, who are these officials? Because as a committee, that's what we're here for. What we call accountability means we'll ask, who are these employees who were giving out tenders without quotations or money without quotations? Because for an employee to know the supply chain management, it must not take an hour. You just have got to take the PMMA, the trusted regulations, and the practice notes and put them here. In an hour's time, you'll be knowing that this is a wrong transaction. Before you even put that, I mean, you can't come here in Parliament and say you need a very serious, complex, complicated workshop on that. Because we think it is easy. For anybody in South Africa, particularly an employee, a clerk for that matter, must know that if the amount is above 500,000 rand, is a public tender. If it is low, quotations. And in fact, even if that's where a lot of corruption happens, in those three quotations, for that matter. We know in South Africa. They even determine who to call for quotations. And who to call last to submit a quotation, because it will be less than the rest of them, and it's guaranteed. We know all those things because we deal with accountability, but those are our same scope. I know what we're talking about here. But we don't have time. The questions that we raised here, we need responses. They must be in writing to the committee. We're going to discuss this report. All those questions you have noted, them, they're very serious questions. They need answers, and there's no time. And I think we need to know who are these officials in supply chain management who do all these things. And if there was action, how many were dismissed? How many were greeted with letters to say, come back to work, keep it in your file for 6 months? In terms of labor relations, you keep any warning letter for 6 months. Other 6 months, you must expunge it, destroy it. It's gone. We need to be very tough on people who don't follow regulations. From now onwards, in NSFAS, must not hear that such things are okay. I cannot appreciate, because if I do so, I will have acted illegally. I cannot appreciate the unqualified report. We will note it is a positive development. It's what had been expected all the time. So it has been done, and then perfect it further so that we remove the other findings, but we need our answers. Thank you for your presentations. You are released. Let's call the Council on Education.
Chairperson, while he's connecting, and maybe I'm preempting here, I think we're faced with something. If what I'm seeing is true, that we have the CEO on his own, alone, coming to present, am I correct, or there are other board members here?
Let's answer that.
Thank you, Chair. I was going to note the chairperson, Professor Manganyi, who was invited, had undergone a surgical procedure a week ago and is unable to travel. And we had originally expected that we were coming in, I think, on the 25th of October or so, in terms of the papers. So it was not possible at short notice to get in. And we don't have a deputy chair, unfortunately.
Okay. Okay.
No, we wish the professor well, but there is no accounting authority here. He is the accounting officer. He must accompany the accounting authority to give technical. I don't know what questions to ask him. He is not the accounting authority. And I mean, I respect him, but I'm just saying, at the level of principle, We don't have the accounting authority yet.
Yeah. Let me allow members to discuss. Probably all of us know that principle, that particularly in matters of this nature, wherein there's to account on the deliverables and how they utilize the finance, is the accounting authority that comes to account, backed up by the technical support staff or whatever you want to. It's not directly those dealing with these matters on day to day who come to account necessarily to us. Although within that process, they are usually given platform to then, because they know these issues, they deal with those. But broadly, it should be that the accounting authority says, yes, we know about this thing. All these matters are said on our behalf. Unlike if we grill and say these are the issues today, only to find that the accounting authority perhaps does not even know about it. So that's the technicality. And obviously, it's somewhat either waste of resources to either postpone or so, but that's what we needed to do.
Just comment and then maybe the whip will advise afterwards. I want to suggest that let's take the presentation because of the principle for value for money. Hear what the official has got to say in relation to all these questions, raise our questions and see how we'll re-engage with the accounting authority. And I must say that the reason for me to suggest as I do is because the BRRR reports are required. Now, as a committee, we'll be required to reflect our position as to the performance of an institution, including the extent to which authorities respect the fact that they ought to come before this committee to account for how they had operated in a financial year, so that you are able to report back to Parliament. On that basis, I would like to beseech the committee to receive the presentation from the CEO and raise questions that you may have, and then note very seriously the fact that not a single member of the board could come here, and we heartily receive the message that we hear of the absence of the head of the accounting authority. Let me take the whip.
Chair, allow me to speak, though I think you have ruled. I was going to say, Chair, even the decency of informing the committee of the engagement of the accounting officer, I think it was necessary, really. And I don't believe that when we talk of the board members, we only talk of three people. I don't see the respect from the council to come and appear before the portfolio committee. I don't see them respecting the committee and the procedures that they need to follow. But then, Chair, as you said that we must continue listening to the presentation, I was going to be of the idea that we don't, but really I cannot, we cannot debate that the Chairperson has spoken.
I'm not rude, I was suggesting, I still would want to hear numbers.
Okay, if it is so, Chairperson, really, I was going to say as a committee, I think this is something that we cannot take. The irrespect that they have just shown to the committee, really, not taking the committee serious, I would have proposed that they go back and come back to back to them.
Thank you. I would like to add to that is that the rule states that we need these documents 48 hours before a meeting. I received mine yesterday. And to prepare properly, that's the work we have to do, is we need the documentation in time. So I would like to agree with the two other members. It's unacceptable. We shouldn't hear the presentation today.
Yes, Honourable Mone.
For now, Chair, I waive my right.
Let me check with Amen on the aspect of documents. When were they sent to us?
Thank you, Chair. The presentation of SAGE was emailed to us yesterday. We sent the invite together with NSFAS the previous week. Beginning of the previous week.
Okay.
No, Chairperson, basically I have spoken. I'm just fearful that we don't necessarily need to be seen to be talking in terms, because we'll be setting a precedent as well. If we get to hear it now, for whatever reason we're giving, in future it may mean that the same could still be done. You know? And I thought all we needed to do, we're still very human. We're raising this thing in good spirit. So it's not like we just same when it comes to principles, that's all. But it's not like we are angry people, we're monsters, we're not. Would want to hear it, if it were in a hurry to hear it, you know, regardless of the technicality that when did it come and so on. So to me, for this particular discussion, that may not be very material. It matters, but I'm just saying what matters the most is the principle as to who should account before us, you know, which we may not want to compromise.
Alison?
I think what has been said is the sentiment that I've
achieved. Can you close it for us?
No. Look, Chairperson, again, I'm just saying that, you know, for me, if I were to condone, I would condone late submission. But this one of the correct people not being present, for me, it's not negotiable. It's really, really not negotiable.
Okay. The role of a chairperson is not to take decisions for members. Manage just to be the facilitator. I mean, edge and do all sorts of stuff. I think it is very clear that members are uncomfortable to receive the presentation in the absence of members of the council. And we really accept your explanation relating to the absence of the chairperson of the council on the basis of health reasons he could not be here. Now, we'll have to reschedule this presentation in accordance with the rules of Parliament. I may not know when. I think you'll have to interact with the administration, because already we've been approached by Parliament with a a bill, the Skills Development Amendment Bill has been properly served before Parliament and is going to be scheduled probably next week. If we are to hear it, it would mean that it would be a matter of negotiating time. But I think the relevant bodies in Parliament would accordingly do that and would be properly informed as members of Parliament as to when we would be able to hear the presentation of the Council on Education. But I must indicate to the Council that if the Council is unable to account for its affairs, its budget may not be passed. That is why I was crying to the committee that they must hear you, because I know that if there's an entity that would not come before us, its budget would not be passed this time around. So let's make sure that we correct the situation and ensure that this very important body is able to do its work, which we value so much as a country. Thank you very much. Then the meeting will be adjourned. Thank you very much.